Listen and stream the all-new talk radio, Freedom 106.5, for the only talk that matter.
Good morning, Trinidad and Tobago. This is Freedom 106.5 FM. Speak your mind. Govin here with you until 12 today, thanking Satish Mahabir for the morning rumble and inviting you to join him again, same time, same place tomorrow morning, right here in Freedom 106.5. So the conversation continues. At this time, we welcome to you our very special segment, Doctors on Call. And as usual, we've got our co-host, Dr. Nadira Rambokas. And also joining us today, we've got a very special guest, Dr. Afraz Ali. Good morning, doctors.
Good morning, Govin. Good morning, Dr. Ali. And good morning, listeners.
Good morning, dear Govin, and to your listeners this morning.
I just want to briefly introduce Dr. Ali. Dr. Afraz Ali has over 29 years as an obstetrician and gynecologist and worked in the public healthcare system for 22 years. He graduated from the University of West Indies, Mona campus, with MBBS, which is Bachelor of Medicine and Bachelor of Surgery. He has fellowship from the Royal College of Obstetrician and Gynecologists from London, membership from the Royal College of Physicians from Ireland, and fellowship from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists from the United States. In addition, he has a postgraduate in business administration and health management. He has multiple published research papers in international journals and is the lead researcher for the Caribbean with the Trium Pharmaceutical Group in developing treatment for human papillomaviral genital infections. So we want to welcome Dr. Ali again today, and I want to dive quickly into his personal life a little bit. So Dr. Ali, how long have you been practicing medicine, and what exactly was your motivation for choosing obstetrics and gynecology in particular?
Thanks very much for having me. You hearing me?
Yes, we are.
Well, I've been practicing for the greater part of 32 years, really. And the motivation for obstetrics and gynecology, actually, it wasn't the first, my first inclination into a subspecialty. My first inclination was internal medicine because I had the fortune of working with Dr. Malcolm Adams and Dr. Premrachan, the late Premrachan. And I sort of got interested in that. But then, as fate would have it, I was posted at the Mount Hope Women's Hospital. And there I worked with the late Professor Sam Rupnarain Singh on his unit. And I realized that obstetrics and gynecology gave me the opportunity to not only practice medicine, internal medicine, but also obstetrics and gynecology, and also neonatology. And that sort of basically had me thinking that this might be the specialty that I would want to pursue. In addition to that, the postgraduate program in obstetrics and gynecology at that time was very, very well structured. And I thought, because of the structuring and because of my aptitude towards this subspecialty, that I will enjoy the rest of my life practicing obstetrics and gynecology. And I found it to be so, and I have not regretted that decision ever since.
Which particular part do you like the most? Is it the obstetrics or the gynecology part? And was there any particular patient or experience that you had that made an impact?
I think over the years, I've come to realize that at different times, there are different occurrences, either encounters with clients, patients, or being able to assist in different aspects of obstetrics and gynecology that has actually, you know, bring satisfaction and some degree of purpose. I think obstetrics, simply because the fact that you are entrusted with not only caring for the female patient, but also for the unborn child, and the whole idea of ensuring that not only the patient, but the child basically has a safe entry into this world. And you do all within the realm of obstetrics to ensure that is most gratifying. And even up to today, the delivery of a newborn is something that is really pleasing, gratifying, not only because it brings joy to the parents, but also you have been part of this historic moment.
Right. And have you ever kept a log of the number of babies you've delivered since you started?
Oh yeah, that's been a pet peeve of mine actually since way back in the Mount Hope days. And from then on I realized, listen, let me see how many lives I've touched who have facilitated an entry into this world. And strangely enough, on the 10th of March last year, 2022, there might be a few plus or minuses, but basically I recorded my 5,000th delivery over these years. And it was a moment when you reflected on it and say, wow, this is, in inverted commas, my life's work. Yeah. I still continue to practice. I still enjoy it. I have great enthusiasm towards looking after persons in upcountry. And in some cases, I've been asked to give advice on the newborn units, et cetera, which obviously, because of these circumstances we currently exist in, I always defer to the pediatricians for advice in that area.
And in your practice, in gynecology, what is some of the most common conditions that you encounter?
In gynecology, the commonest condition, I would say, would be menstrual irregularities, whether it be the absence of menstrual cycles, the irregular cycling, or, basically when the periods have stopped, or, basically severe period pains, heavy bleedings. That's the commonest condition affecting females. And it varies, depending upon the age, from prepubescent straight on to menopausal thing. That's closely followed by conditions such as uterine fibroids, which is common not only in Trinidad and Tobago, but in the Caribbean and among Caribbean people. And we are now seeing the advent, either because we are picking it up more, we're doing more investigative work, but endometriosis is a close third to all of those things.
And so far in your practice, would you say is the most common reasons for menstrual irregularities? Is it hormonal abnormalities? Is it polycystic ovaries? Is it COVID infections?
Well, anytime you're presented with the condition where you have difficulty with menses, I think obviously, as we all taught, you need to, have a thorough history, because there are several things that can impact on your menstrual cycle. Obviously, the age of the person is important, but in our setting, at least in my experience, menstrual irregularities are really hormonal in nature, and polycystic ovaries, as we come to know, is really affects the hormonal milieu of the female body, and that in itself. So the irregular cycling or the abnormal cycling is really a direct result of that change. And as we know, the different things can impact on the hormonal level and the concentrations, because simple things as extreme stressors, extreme weight gain, weight loss, apart from basically malfunction in certain systems, and also anything that is exogenous that you're taking in for one reason or the other can actually impact on those things and cause menstrual irregularities.
Can you tell women out there, for instance, when they should get worried in terms of longer duration of period, a lot of pain during your period, heavier periods? Could you tell us, does it take one cycle or several cycles?
I think it's important, as I say to all my patients, that while it is a common occurrence where women get together and they compare menstrual cycles, compare experiences, each woman is different and your cycle is unique to you. And I think the first thing one needs to do is really understand what your cycle is. And your cycle is not only when you have the period, it's really from the beginning of one period to the beginning of the next period. And if you start you know, basically logging a number of days between those events, you begin to get what you call the cycle length. And then obviously you will have your period that can last anywhere between 1 and 7 days. That's considered to be the normal. And obviously you will always have in your experience, you know, how many heavy days you have and how many light days you have. Now, once you've established that pattern and you begin to move away from that pattern and it happens in one cycle, you know, your cycle is late and then it gets very heavy, and then you're seeing that pattern repeating itself, then that becomes a flag for you to say, listen, let me go and check this out. There may be something happening here that's not. It is common to have a missed cycle. It is also common to have an abnormal period of bleed in 1 or 2 cycles. But if it continues to happen over and over, then yes, you need to consult your physician and get it checked out. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you notice that, you know, most ladies will, females will have pain with the periods, and they will have that pattern of pain for a couple number of days. If that pattern changes, then obviously pain is always a symptom that you should not ignore. And if you notice that it's changing, it's becoming increasingly unbearable, disrupting your work life, your school life, then obviously it needs to be checked out also.
And when these patients approach you, how do you further investigate them?
Well, in terms of menstrual thing, obviously, as I said before, you need to have a proper discussion with them in terms of what we would call a history taking. And that's aimed to get information about your previous menstrual cycles, what you're accustomed having, what has changed, are there any other associated illnesses that you may have developed. And you mentioned COVID before, which basically did cause, and we are seeing some disruptions in the menstrual cycle. So things like that you will elucidate in the history. And as you go on, obviously, you will do your physical examination. What you're looking at is your BMI. You're looking to see any signs of hirsutism, any signs of, you know, galactorium coming out from the breast. Signs that may allude to other diseases like Cushing syndrome, which is a abnormality of the adrenal glands. And these things really would clue you in into how to focus your investigations. Obviously, part of the examination will involve a pelvic exam, whether it be a manual pelvic exam or a ultrasound-associated pelvic exam. And then you're looking at, you know, things like ovarian cysts, polycystic ovaries, any other associated conditions that can lead to changes in the hormonal levels that can cause cyclic abnormalities. Once you've done that, you would have a fairly good idea what your differential is. And you can now couple those findings with investigations. And investigations with things like thyroid function tests, your luteinizing hormone, FSH hormone, prolactin, those things, tests. And what that does is allow you now to focus your intervention, if it's necessary, on the correction. It's not always about using the oral contraceptive pill to correct the cycle and then hoping that it corrects itself. One needs to get at the causative factors that lead to that.
Right. So you told us about the duration of a normal period. Can you tell us how much blood loss is expected for a normal period and what is considered heavy?
Right. Well, you know, as I said, that's variable, and it really depends on what you have logged over the months or years from the time you started your period. And now we notice that girls are having their first menses, the menarche as we call it, at the age of 8.5, 9. It's a very early one. So obviously, a bit earlier. Now the issue here is really when studies have been done to actually quantify the blood loss during what might consider to be a normal menstrual cycle. And they did that by collecting all the sanitary towels and all the tampons, etc., and actually quantifying the blood loss. It's anywhere between 80 and 100 mils in a normal cycle. Now, what clues you in terms of something becoming abnormal is if that you've never experienced clots and large clots. And that usually tells you the bleeding is heavy, the mechanism that prevents the menstrual blood from clotting is overwhelmed. and then you have these large clots obviously associated with pain. Once you see that pattern and change and you notice that the cycles are going on, say, greater than 7 days, 10 days, and you continue to have heavy flows, or your flows, your heavy days change from 2 days to about 5 or 6 days, then obviously that is something that should alert you to having some consultation with your physician. And obviously you will do things like blood count to see if it's impacted in your complete blood count or hemoglobin concentration, as we said. So those, it really depends on what your pattern is and what you're accustomed to, and you will know when that changes.
Okay, thank you. We have to take a short commercial break. Yeah. I want to come back. We'll be talking about fibroids and polycystic ovaries.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.
And welcome back to Doctors on Call, Dr. Rambukas and Dr. Ali with us this morning.
Thank you, Govan, and thank you, listeners. Again, Dr. Ali, I just wanted to educate the public about, because this is some common conditions like fibroids. What exactly are fibroids? I know it's mispronounced a lot. And how do they normally present, and what are some of the symptoms women may experience?
Right, so fibroids are, as I said, is very common in the Caribbean and among Caribbean people. And fibroids are what we know as benign, meaning non-cancerous growths or tumors. When you hear tumor, your mind usually takes you to cancer, but it's a non-cancerous growth. And commonly, it basically arises from the muscle of the uterus, what we call the myometrium. Now, fibroids are usually classified depending upon where in the uterus they reside. So you'll have those that are closer to the surface of the uterus, we call subserosal, those that are in the muscle, or the substance of the muscle, which we call intramural. And then you have those that are close to the endometrium, or the cavity of the uterus, which you can call submucosal. And the reason for saying those things is because depending upon where they reside, then it determines the symptoms that you get. So for instance, subserosal fibroids generally can reside there for a long time, be of a different size, and you will not get any pains. Whereas those that are intramural and submucosal will tend to give you what we call secondary dysmenorrhea. You never had period pains before, but all of a sudden you started getting period pains. So they cause period pains and they cause increase in the menstrual flow, menorrhagia, as we call it. Typically, you'll find that women will have fibroids, but when they visit their physicians for their annual checkups, you'll find that it's discovered. So it's an incidental finding in most cases. Sometimes you will have an ultrasound done for a different reason, to rule out, say, a bladder stone or bladder calculus, and the ultrasonographer, by virtue of the examination, will pick up what we call fibroids of different sizes in uterus, and you would never have known that. And so obviously the majority of them are asymptomatic. Now, when it is that they become larger, or basically they begin to influence the menstrual cycles, you would see a change in the pattern, as we said. The bleeding gets heavier, you have more heavy days than you're aware of. You begin to get large clots in the menstrual loss, and associated with that is severe pains. So some women basically will have that. They ignore it initially, and then they realize, listen, this is not something I could ignore. So they visit their doctors because they now have what is called symptomatic fibroids, is providing symptoms for you. Some persons, because obviously they're really not interested in knowing, because they figure it's all going to be bad, but wait until they begin to manifest symptoms of anemia, which is really shortness of breath, headaches, easy fatigability, and then realize that something is wrong, let me check it out. And I've seen in my practice, women would wait to the stage where their blood count is 6, where they begin to get severe chest pains, and then decide that I cannot continue again, I need to check this out. And obviously you would need to apply the appropriate interventions there. So fibroids generally would cause those symptoms. Now, generally, sometimes the first thing a woman realizes is, wait, my lower part of my tummy is getting large. She doesn't have any menstrual irregularities. She doesn't have any heavy flow, menorrhagia. She doesn't have any pain. but the tummy is getting larger. And you find that when it's checked out, you realize that it's a large uterus with multiple uterine fibroids in it. So sometimes that's the first presentation that you would get from a patient with respect to that, a mass in, arising out of the pelvis. And obviously, as the fibroids get larger, and they tend to grow with each menstrual cycle, and over a period of time, they get larger, then you begin to worry about compression in different organs. So for instance, the bladder is the first one that will manifest in terms of frequency, and you find that you need to go very often, but when you go, the volume of urine that you pass is very little. That's one. Two, if it's really large and dependent and based on the anatomy, the ureter that passes from the kidney to the bladder is right very close to the uterus there. Sometimes gets compressed and you get renal symptoms. So sometimes you may get renal pain as a result of that compression and what we call hydronephrosis, where the kidney begins to get enlarged because of backup of urine there. So these are some of the things that fibroids can cause. Obviously, there are some women who wait until the fibroids are so large that it's way above the umbilicus, and they realize they've put on weight, their clothes can't fit them anymore. And then it says, okay, well, now it's time that I need to check this out. Generally, fibroids, some women, or some, depending upon the position in the uterus, can present with subfertility, having difficulty in getting pregnant. And when you begin to investigate, you would realize that everything else is normal, but these are the only abnormalities that exist. And you may now begin to look closer at whether or not it's impacting on the tubal ostea or the opening of the tube into the uterus that can possibly be a cause for the subfertility. So those are some of the presentations that you would get
with fibroids. Could you tell us some of the interventions that might be necessary, both medical and surgical, with these?
But the treatment options have changed over the years, and let's just see if we can section it up. For those that are asymptomatic and small fibroids, so that cohort or group of persons, I think what you really need to do is to monitor. I think there's no need to rush in and prescribe this and that for it. You just need to monitor, and obviously you can determine the frequency of monitoring. And monitoring is best done with a pelvic ultrasound rather than just saying you have any change. And simply because with the pelvic ultrasounds, and especially a transvaginal scan, you can actually measure the fibroids. So you can measure the fibroids and determine the growth of the fibroids, whether or not the numbers of fibroids are increasing, whether or not, you know, basically the pattern has changed, because sometimes you can see calcification and different changes within the fibroid that will allude to certain things. So that's asymptomatic, so you monitor. In persons who have symptomatic fibroids, meaning that they have crossed the threshold, they're having severe period pains, menorrhagia, the treatment very much depends on the patient aspirations. And by that I mean, so if the patient just wants to have a normal flow or have basically less pain, you may want to offer, but don't necessarily want surgery. You may need to offer medical intervention. And some of the medical intervention is aimed at reducing the menstrual flow, and in some cases by just stopping the period for a point in time. What that does is really allow the patient to recover, especially the blood count, make them a little bit more comfortable during the cycles. And in addition to that, it sort of slows the growth of the fibroid. So it's a temporizing measure. It is used in some persons who absolutely don't want surgery. I know it's there. I just want to control my pain and the bleeding. And you manage it accordingly, and you continue to monitor it going forward from there. Those patients who are not averse to surgery but have all these problems and say, listen, I want this corrected, but I want to preserve my fertility, my options of a pregnancy, you'll find in those persons you can offer them what is called a myomectomy. Now, myomectomies can be done several ways. It can be done laparoscopically. It can be done as an open procedure. I would say here that patient selection is extremely important in terms of determining which is the best procedure for you. for those who are also mindful of the fact there's something called fibroid embolization or uterine fibroid embolization. And again, it's where you target the blood supply to the fibroid. And by interrupting that supply, you basically inhibit the fibroid growth and, you know, prevent symptoms from getting worse or reduce some of the symptoms. Now, contrary to what people generally think, fibroid embolization doesn't make the fibroid go away. It doesn't make it disappear. They may shrink a bit and they may give you less symptoms, but it's still there. And because all you're doing is really interrupting the blood supply. It doesn't evaporate. It doesn't go anywhere. What your body does is put calcium around it, as any tissue that has died, in attempt to wall it off. So you have those procedures that can be done for women who want to preserve fertility. Laparoscopically, obviously, it's something that is gaining fashion now. But again, as I said, patient selection has to be absolutely critical. Otherwise, you will find yourself with having to convert a laparoscopic procedure into an open procedure or having to come back for an open procedure because the first procedure has failed. And there are different disadvantages and advantages of both methods. That the persons who said, listen, I've completed my family, I have fibroids, I am really finding it difficult on a monthly basis to have heavy periods, painful periods, go through this over and over. And for those persons, they may want to say, listen, can I have a simple hysterectomy, which is really to remove the uterus with all the fibroids in it. I am aware that I would not be able to have any more pregnancies, and I'm aware that I'm not going to have any more periods. I just need to have it out. And in those cases, basically, that's acceptable once they have been counseled properly. Because in my experience, the uterus holds a special place in a woman's psyche. And I think you really need to have that conversation with the person before just saying, okay, you need to have a hysterectomy. Let's go ahead and do it. And I think it's important to understand that the procedure is an easy procedure. Is what comes afterwards is important, really. And once you do that, and you have that sort of relationship with the patient, then obviously things work well in terms of expectation post hysterectomy. So those are the modalities that exist. Now, as we're talking about fibroids, in a very small percentage of women, fibroid, less than 0.5%, fibroids can become malignant. Right? They develop what is called a leiomyosarcoma of a fibroid. And you will see changes because they start to grow rapidly. You get severe pain. And when you look at the ultrasound, you can see some changes that alert you to this not being normal. And a situation like that, obviously, doesn't happen. Fortunately, it doesn't happen very commonly. But when it does happen, it's important for you to pick it up because it's a condition that needs to be aggressively pursued and treated.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Ali. We have to take a short commercial break, and when we come back, we'll be talking about polycystic ovaries.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.
And welcome back right here on Freedom 106.5 FM with Dr. Rambukas and Dr. Ali. Doctors, we've got a question coming in on WhatsApp. I could pose this question at this point. The texter says, I suspect I have PCOS, but I have always managed my symptoms without birth control. Asking about the benefit of being formally diagnosed, if I don't want to go on the pill, and also will there be some point in the future, such as at that menopausal state when diagnosis may become impossible, and if I may regret not seeing the doctor sooner. And another question is vaginal arthropathy associated with PCOS in young women.
I think maybe we should define what polycystic ovaries is, and then we could go on to how it's normally diagnosed and treated, and then we can deal with like the individual patients that just messaged. Dr. Ali?
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, I think in the conversation, we may be able to provide the person with the answers. So polycystic ovaries, as we commonly hear it's being referred to, is not the same as polycystic ovarian syndrome. I think that's the first thing we need to understand. Polycystic ovaries could be an incidental diagnosis or finding when you're doing a pelvic ultrasound. And the reason I make this distinction is for it to be very clear, and it may allude to some part of the question. So sometimes when you do an ultrasound, you see ovaries that are polycystic nature, and there's a defined criteria on ultrasound for making that diagnosis. But you'll find that when you question or when you have a chat with the patient, you'll find that their menstrual cycles are normal, they have a normal BMI, they function normally, they have absolutely no problems at all, but it's a finding that we get an ultrasound. Does that mean that they have polycystic ovarian syndrome? The answer to that is no. They don't have polycystic ovarian syndrome. They don't need any treatment at all. And for want of a better plan, you may just want to monitor them over the year. On an annual basis, you look at the ovaries again, or if it is that menstrual irregularities set in or any other condition begins to become noticeable, then obviously you need to take a closer look. So that's one subset of persons so not all persons who have an ultrasound that you see polycystic ovaries or need to be treated, first of all. We come to polycystic ovarian syndrome, which is a different kettle of fish altogether. And there are different phenotypes that are associated with that. Phenotype meaning that how you look, how you function. You have those that have increased hair growth, abnormal hair growth, meaning that you have a male pattern of hair growth under the chin, the chest, coming up to the navel. And generally, the hair quality is not the soft, downy type, but it's really the more masculine type of hair growth. So you have hirsutism, as we say. You may have increase in weight where you have, when you cross a certain BMI, we call it overweight or obese, depending upon where the BMI functions lie. You have cycle abnormalities. So sometimes the first presentation is really cycle abnormalities, as we alluded to before. So you begin to miss cycles. The periods are usually late. And when they're late, obviously you have sort of abnormal bleeding where you have maybe some spotting before the period, you have the flow and then spotting again. So all of these things you begin to notice that, or you may find that it starts off like this and then all of a sudden the period stops. No more period. Although you're a very young person, accustomed to having regular cycles, the period has suddenly stopped. And in a situation like that where the period has suddenly stopped, once you've ruled out a pregnancy, which is obviously the commonest cause of not having a period, you begin to now look to see whether the other features of polycystic ovarian syndrome are there. And for that, basically, you will need to do investigations and we come to that. Now, some persons basically would just present to you with difficulty in getting pregnant. So over the time, they've been trying to get pregnant and they have been unable to get pregnant. And when you begin to do your investigations, you begin to realize that, listen, there is a problem here. So the investigations are usually along the line of, obviously you do a complete physical examination, you know what your BMI is, you look for hair growth, abnormal hair growth, you look for other stigmata of the disease. And obviously you would also want to find out what sort of other medical conditions they may have, because that will impact on it. You also want to find out if they're on any pharmaceutical agents, whether or not they're taking any vitamins or any different, what I call alternative medicine remedies that we find ourselves taking these days. And that will sort of clue you in terms of the possibility of either the cycle abnormality being iatrogenic, meaning basically caused, or basically as a result of the disease. In terms of investigations for polycystic ovarian syndrome, so you have those that have hirsutism, cycle abnormalities, and you have an ovary that is polycystic. And generally, when you look at the ovary and you see the ultrasound pictures, you'll see that it's a ring of small cysts on the outside of the ovary, under the lining of the ovary. And the cysts are usually small. They're usually between 5 millimeters, 7 millimeters, 8 millimeters most. One of the common questions women have is, are these cysts going to get large? And by and large, they don't. They remain in those small things. because the ovary is such a very active organ, the ovary continuously repairs itself. So you find that the cyst you see today is not the same cyst you see 3 months down the road, because there's a continuous repair and formation. So you have that type, and then you have a next subtype of women who have no lysitism but cycle abnormalities and obviously polycystic ovaries. Investigations, really, the ultrasound is one part of it, as we said, and we'll discount that for now. But the blood investigations are important, and you would do blood investigations to establish what the hormonal pattern is. And typically, you would want to rule out thyroid disease, so you do a thyroid function test. You would want to rule out hyperprolactinemia, which is prolactin that causes milk from the breast, because that can also affect the cycles. You would want to rule out adrenal causes, and by doing so, that's because adrenal hyperplasia can cause hirsutism, and it can cause cycle abnormalities also. And you would want to do hormonal studies specific to the female hormonal system that acts from the pituitary gland to the ovary, the LH, FSH. You would want to measure testosterone and DHEAS. All of those are important in allowing you to determine whether or not you have a hormonal abnormality that exists. Now, once you've done all of that and you said, okay, fine, this person has polycystic ovarian syndrome, your plan of management very much depends on, again, aspirations. So, as I said, there are two phenotypes. So if the person is having regular cycle, not hirsute, doesn't have a care, but and the hormonal profile comes back as normal, but they still have polycystic ovaries, you just monitor that. But those who have abnormal hormonal profiles and those who have polycystic ovaries and cycle abnormalities, you may want to offer them treatment. And the simplest and commonest form of treatment for that is really the oral contraceptive pill. But there are specific pills that are used for women with polycystic ovaries that has as the progesterone an anti-androgen. And that anti-androgen reduces the male hormone, because typically you would have an increase in male hormones in the syndrome that causes the hirsutism and everything else. And I'm assuming that you have not ruled out adrenal hyperplasia. So you would want to use that, and you'll want to use it over a period of time, because what it does is really bring the male hormones down, allow you to recreate the cycle. So from the psyche point of view, the person is having a period on a monthly basis, which is always reassuring. And in addition to that, it allows the ovaries to rest and repair itself. So as you know, the oral contraceptive pill works in that it shuts the axis down so that the ovary doesn't go through its normal cycling. And what you have is an artificial cycle there. So that allows, and that's the simplest and commonest way to actually assist the condition. This is assuming that the person is not interested in pregnancy and just wants to have a regular cycle, control the hair growth and everything else, control the acne, which is also sometimes present in these conditions. Those who are interested in pregnancy and have all of these things, then obviously you would need to make a correction. And sometimes the best way is not to dive right into ovulation indoctrination. So everybody is familiar with Clomid and a couple other things on the market. One may want to sort of create the environment inside where you have control of the cycles and then want to actually induce ovulation and go through the fertility management aspect of it. And that's a discussion that you would have to have with the couple and work out a plan for that. And the reason for that is once you settle everything inside, the chances of a successful pregnancy is greater. So it's not like I have polycystic ovaries, I put you on this and I hope for the best. It's important to have a plan with respect to that. And in certain cases where you've done all of these things and obviously the couple is desirous of a pregnancy, then they really have tried everything else and it hasn't worked, there is the option of doing what is called laparoscopic ovarian diatomy. And from very early on in gynecological history, way back in Stein-Leventhal days, they found that if you destroy a certain portion of the ovary by virtue of the lesser mass, is now able to respond properly. And ovarian diatomy does that by destroying small areas of the ovary. And what you have is a window of opportunity afterwards in where you can get pregnant. It works quite well. Again, you have to choose your patients wisely, and you have to create the environment to facilitate the whole thing. So by itself, it may not work for itself, but once you create that environment and cause that facilitative environment, then obviously you most likely would end up with success. Some patients who just want to see about the hair growth, obviously you can use the anti-androgens to reduce the androgenic environment. Or if they're, you know, not really keen on taking tablets and pills, but just want the hair to go away, then there's several aesthetic procedures that can be done to facilitate that.
Dr. Ali, I think one of the persons who had mentioned about polycystic ovaries, but I think she really meant the syndrome. Is there any dietary restriction? I know some patients use inositol. And do we routinely check persons who have polycystic ovarian syndrome for dyslipidemia, their blood sugars, for insulin resistance?
I think that's an important thing. I omitted to mention that. And yes, when you would check for dyslipidemia, especially, you know, obviously where obesity is a factor, the BMIs are high. It's a feature that exists. Insulin resistance by virtue of the change in the hormonal environment do occur. It doesn't occur in every patient, but obviously it's good to check. I know a couple of years ago there was a couple of studies that used metformin as a first line option in terms of attempting to treat the insulin resistance. So these things, yeah, you would check for them. I don't think most people do the look for insulin antibodies, et cetera, et cetera. Myo-inositol, in terms of persons who are attempting to be conceived, seems to have some beneficial effect on that cohort of persons. And it's a useful supplement for those persons who are attempting to get pregnant.
And the other patient had asked about vaginal atrophy with polycystic ovarian syndrome. Is that a common feature?
It's not a common feature. I mean, the thing about it is, if it is that it's associated with other conditions, then you may experience some vaginal dryness. And obviously, the commonest presentation of that is dyspareunia, which is pain and difficulty during intercourse. But generally, it's not a key feature in presentation, but it can occur in the odd person where you have an associated condition.
Right. So thank you, Dr. Ali. When we return, we'll be talking a little bit about menopause. We have to take a short break.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.
And we're back, freedom106.5, back to our conversations with our doctors, Dr. Rambukas and Dr. Ali.
So, Dr. Ali, switching gears a little bit from fibroids and polycystic ovarian syndrome, we're talking about older ladies now. What exactly is menopause? And why do women have to go through menopause? And how can some of these women who are symptomatic manage their symptoms?
Right. So, menopause, as when the exact word is really when the periods have stopped or you have cessation of the menses. But before that occurs, you'll find that there is a period where each woman will go through what we call the perimenopause. And what the perimenopause does is really begin to acclimatize the woman in what will happen during the menopause. Not a very nice period, because it's great with uncertainty. And obviously, most women are so concerned that, am I in the menopause? That's a question they commonly ask. So what you would get is really menopause occurs because obviously the ovarian cycle, like everything else, there is a lifespan to it. And the ovaries, as we go through the years, age. So you'll find that the normal function or cyclical function that you get in the ovaries begin to go away or begin to cease. And more importantly, and the event associated with that is really the what you might call the regular production of egg or follicle, ovulation, et cetera, et cetera. And once those don't occur, you don't have the normal ovarian cycle. So it's an aging process of the ovary, and you'll find that because there is a feedback mechanism from the ovary to the pituitary gland head, you'll find that it's very easy to diagnose menopause. If you had, you weren't sure about what was happening, it's an extremely simple thing to do. Now, the issue with menopause is really the distress that it causes, and the distress is really throughout the body. And the reason for that is estrogen is such a vital hormone in the daily operations of the female body, in that once the levels begin to fall, you begin to experience, in the commonest form, vasomotor symptoms, which are the hot flushes and flashes. Typically, upper body, typically you will get up at night drenched in sweat and then realize, well, isn't the air conditioner working or the fan? And that's a vasomotor symptom. So it's the most distressing symptom that begins to manifest itself very early on. And in addition to that, sometimes it's coupled by what we call mood lability, where for some days you'll be very, very good, perfectly normal, and then obviously the drop of a pin, you will not, as Trinidadians would say, you lose it. So you become very irritable, you become depressed, melancholic, so tearfulness and crying. Even in a crowd with your friends, you just start to be, you know, very teary and teary-eyed for the simplest of things. So these things are all distressing. In addition to that, you begin to, that's the mood changes and the hot flushes and flashes that we are coming to. But while all of this is happening, the body undergoes changes. So you begin to notice a different texture and quality of the hair. The hair begins to thin. You notice that you lose body mass or you lose weight, and the skin becomes very thin, and instead of a nice smooth skin, it begins a little bit coarse. So these changes begin to occur. And in addition to that, in some women, depending upon, you know, how they enter into this period, they begin to get what we call a kyphosis. They start to bend a bit. So you lose height. And you'll find that when you do your x-rays, incidentally, you might find loss of bone mass. Not very prevalent in Caribbean people, because we enter to this period because of our sunshine and the vitamin D and everything else with a fairly good reserve. But in addition to that, and the cycle abnormality or the cessation of the period as menopause indicates, you begin to get the genital structures begin to atrophy. And by that I mean you would begin to lose the fatty tissue in the vulval area. You begin to have vaginal dryness. The uterus becomes very, very small and atrophic. And when you look at the ovaries also, they are atrophic and very, very quiet. And all of these things take place inside. Now, there are other changes that occur because, as I said, obviously, estrogen is a very important thing. So cardiovascular changes occur. You have atrophy of the breast, so the breast tissue begins to shrink and you lose that sort of tissue. So all of these things happen, and it creates a different body image altogether for the female. And that in itself basically weighs again on the psychological impact menopause has. There are different things you can do. It all depends on, and I think it very much depends on how much information the particular person has about menopause, and whether or not it's all doom and gloom, or whether or not you embrace it and you deal with it head on. And I think the latter is the most effective way of dealing with it. Now, generally before, maybe about 10, 15 years ago, hormone replacement therapy was the in thing. So from the time you think you're in menopause, you start on hormone replacement therapy. But then quickly, women found out that, listen, I really don't want to have a period, but I'm not supposed to have a period because I find it very inconvenient. And because of different, how shall I put it, risk factors associated with replacement therapy, alternative forms of managing these symptoms in in the menopause occurred. And some of them are extremely effective, but it all depends on the person and the individual. So you'll find that there are estrogen-like substances in plant derivatives, what we call phytoestrogens. So you'll find things like soya, ground provisions, and a host of other things really would provide you with the phytoestrogens that ameliorate some of those symptoms. So you'll find that once I have that in my diet and I include that in my diet, I can actually manage the hot flushes and the flushes. Like everything else, we like it very easy in terms of that. So the companies have taken all of those things and put it in a little pill, and you just take a pill every day. Does the same thing. But again, it comes back to whether or not you like taking a pill every day. So lifestyle changes can actually help with that. Exercise is a big thing. So for instance, if you get into an exercise program, whether it's yoga, weightlifting exercise, cardiovascular exercise, you tend to actually create a level of serotonin in the cerebellum that assists with the vasomotor symptoms, with these psychological abnormalities that you think, the irritability and mood swings. And it creates a sense of euphoria sometimes, where you feel not down and depressed at all times. So it's really very good. So lifestyle changes, definitely, yes, will assist your dietary needs. You manage it. In some patients, even though you would do all of that, they still need additional support, whether it be talking to a psychologist, giving a small amount of add-back estrogen therapy under very, very close circumstances. Because for women who have not had a hysterectomy, who have the uterus intact, estrogen or unopposed estrogen can cause problems in terms of thickening of the endometrium or the lining, which is not always very good in this stage. I will hasten to say that women are not the only ones who are affected with, and as I say, men are affected with similar symptoms. The only thing about men is that their decline starts very early on, as early as 30, and comes straight on in terms of their testosterone level. But they have the same sort of symptoms, et cetera, et cetera. So we are equally at risk.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Ali. How can you be contacted if our patients are trying to reach you?
They can reach me on 763-4872. That's one of the numbers. The other one would be 464-6952.
Thank you, Dr. Ali. We want to thank you today again for being educational and informative. I want to thank my co-host and for our listeners, and do have a great day.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you so much, doctors, Dr. Rambokas and Dr. Ali, joining us today right here on Freedom 106.5 for Doctors on Call. And you, of course, you can join us next week, Thursday, same time, same place, for another exciting edition right here on Freedom 106.5 FM.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.